You're listening to the English language news of Khan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
It's 8 p.m. in Israel, Thursday, March 21st, 2024. In the headlines, IDF operation in Shifa Hospital kills 50 more terrorists and captures scores more, including a senior Hamas and Islamic Jihad commanders. The U.S. submits to the U.N. Security Council a draft resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza tied to the hostages. As efforts to impose a ceasefire heighten, a senior Israeli minister says Israel would fight on in Rafah even if the entire world turns on Israel. Israeli air defense intercept an object heading towards Eilat over the Red Sea. The Mossad head is heading to Qatar amid optimism over a hostage deal. The IDF raids in Tulkarm refugee camp in the West Bank kills four terrorists. And the weather, rain and thundershowers overnight and colder tomorrow. Good evening. This is Arye O'Sullivan with the news. This is the 167th day of the war. IDF and Shin Bet forces continue to operate in the Shifa Hospital in Gaza and killed more than 50 terrorists in the past day. Since the start of the raid on Monday, more than 140 terrorists were eliminated in the hospital and surrounding area, and more than 650 terrorists were captured, including dozens of senior Hamas and Islamic Jihad commanders. The IDF says that the terrorists had attempted to turn the Shifa Hospital back into their command headquarters as before the October 7th war. The IDF spokesperson said that Israeli security forces are taking measures to avoid harm to patients and medical staff. Palestinian sources released a recording purportedly by the IDF cautioning patients and medical teams not to flee and not to open fire. "We will go through the hospitals until we find the hostages and release you. Remain in the hospital until you receive other directives," the recording said. Among the senior Hamas commanders captured was Mahmoud Kawasme, one of the planners of the 2014 kidnapping and murder of three Israeli teens in Judea. Sources in the Gaza Strip say that near Bani Shaula, near Khan Yunis, three people were killed in a strike on a car. There were no immediate details of their identities. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says that nearly 32,000 Palestinians have been killed and more than 74,000 others wounded since the start of the war. The numbers are unverified and do not differentiate between combatants and civilians. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said the IDF operation in Shifa Hospital showed the Army's improved fighting prowess. He said that a half a year ago, it took the IDF a month to reach the hospital, which is in central Gaza City, but now the operation was carried out within minutes. Speaking before troops in the Gaza division, he said that the terrorists who were holed up in the hospital could either surrender or be killed. 35% of all the buildings in the Gaza Strip have been damaged in the war, and 31,000 of them were completely destroyed. This, according to the United Nations Research Institute, which based their findings on photos taken at the end of February, which show greater destruction than initially estimated. The analysis of the photos show that about 80,000 buildings were damaged in the Gaza Strip. The greatest damage is in the city of Khan Yunis, where about 12,000 buildings were destroyed. The United States has submitted a draft resolution to the United Nations Security Council calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza tied to the release of Israeli hostages. The U.S. has vetoed three previous similar ceasefire resolutions at the U.N. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in an interview with the Saudi media outlet Al Arabiya that he believed it would send a strong message.
"We actually have a resolution that we put forward right now that's before the United Nations Security Council that does call for an immediate ceasefire tied to the release of hostages. And we hope very much that countries will support that. I think that would send a strong message, a strong signal. But, of course, we stand with Israel in its right to defend itself, to make sure that October 7th never happens again. But at the same time, it's imperative that the civilians who are in harm's way and who are suffering so terribly, that we focus on them, that we make them a priority, protecting the civilians, getting them humanitarian assistance. And we've been leading the effort to do that, to get more in, to get more to the people who need it. We are pressing on that as hard as we can."
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Blinken says he thinks the gaps are narrowing in the ceasefire hostage release talks and an agreement is very much possible. Blinken is in Egypt today, where he is slated to meet with the counterparts, his counterparts from several Arab countries. Palestinian sources told Sky News in Arabic that the ministers from Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates, plus PLO Secretary General, will call on Washington to recognize a Palestinian state. They will also urge the U.S. to prevent an Israeli military operation in Rafah. Secretary of State Blinken is expected to come to Israel from Egypt for a few hours tomorrow, his sixth visit to the region since October 7th. He's expected to attend the meeting of the War Cabinet in the morning. Strategic Affairs Minister Ron Dermer is headed to Washington next week as part of a small delegation that will also include National Security Advisor Tsachi Hanegbi and a representative of the Coordinator of Government Activities in the Territories, at the direct request of U.S. President Joe Biden, whose administration is deeply opposing Israel's plan to launch a ground operation in Rafah to complete the defeat of Hamas and its allies. Dermer, who rarely appears in the media, is a former ambassador to Washington and very close to Netanyahu. He said in remarks broadcast today that the IDF assault on Rafah was definitely going to happen, even if the entire world turns on Israel. "We're going to fight until the battle is won," Dermer said. "There's only one possible force that could stop Israel, and that's the Israeli people." He was speaking with writer Dan Sinor on his Call Me Back podcast. Here are some excerpts from that interview.
"We're going to Rafah because we have to dismantle Hamas's military capabilities. If you leave four battalions in Rafah, you've lost the war. And Israel's not going to lose the war. With or without the United States, we're not going to do it. We have no choice. And I think what people don't understand is that October 7th is an existential moment for Israel. It's the first time in my lifetime, we're about the same age, where the existential nerve of the Jewish people was touched. And, you know, we remember this expulsion of the Jews from Spain in the 15th century, but that's 500 years ago. The Holocaust is not 500 years ago. It's not. It's in living memory. You still have survivors of the Holocaust who are walking amongst us. What you saw on October 7th was a genocidal force that wants to wipe out all the Jews, and it's the first pogrom that we've had since the birth of the State of Israel. And in a fundamental way, the promise of this country, in my view, is not just that Jews return to their ancestral homeland. It's that we have the ability to defend ourselves. And in a fundamental way, that promise was broken on October 7th. And I think our job is to restore that promise. And that means utterly dismantling the terror organization of Hamas in Gaza. It's going to happen. And it will happen even if Israel is forced to fight alone. Even if the entire world turns on Israel, including the United States, we're going to fight until the battle won. There's only one possible force that could stop Israel, and that's the Israeli people. And go around this country and speak to them. And speak to them across the religious, across the ideological, spectrum. Religious, it's, political
spectrum. I've never
spectrum.
Seen anything like it.
Yeah. We're united to achieve the goal. And there will be political differences and there will be different opinions about different issues. And the day after conversation is a very important conversation in the halls of Washington and London and elsewhere. In Israel, it's much less of a conversation. What everybody knows, and I think they understand it on a visceral level, and they're right, that organization that did what they did on October 7th has to be wiped out. And it's not rage, which is sometimes Israel is accused of doing. You know, you're 9/11 and we responded in Afghanistan. I mean, Dan, look, this is on our border. And remember, we are a citizens' army. We're not sending, you know, 1 or 2% of our population, if you think military families writ large, to some distant land to fight a war. It's literally hundreds of yards away from our border. And you have your own sons and daughters are fighting this war. You know, one of the members of our war cabinet lost the son in Gaza. I mean, how many democratic countries around the world are decision makers?
A son and a nephew.
A son and a nephew, yeah. Right. And people, you know, you sit around the table and you know, my son is here and my son is there and my daughter's here. That's what happens in Israel. And the absurd notion that the people of Israel simply don't know what's in our interest.
And 200,000 people internally displaced who can't return to their homes.
Yeah, but the basic thing is we're going to go in and finish this job. And anybody who doesn't understand that doesn't understand that the nerve of the Jews, that existential nerve, was touched. The goal of the war in my view at least, was never, and when we talk about dismantling Hamas's military capabilities, it was never, you're going to kill every single Hamas terrorist in Gaza. And a couple months ago, a senior American official was here, and he came to our war cabinet, and he said, you know, Hamas is an idea, and you can't destroy an idea. And I said in response, well, Nazism is an idea. And there are Nazis in Charlottesville that are walking around with tiki torches that they got at Bed Bath & Beyond. But they don't have a country called Germany that they control. And the power of an idea combined with an army and territory that they can control to lethal effect is night and day. ISIS, I said to this American official, ISIS is an idea. And there are people in the Middle East, and there are people in Europe, and even people in the United States, that if you probably went into their living rooms or bedrooms, you're going to find the black flag of ISIS on the wall. But they don't have a caliphate in Syria and Iraq. You have to deny them territory. So the goal when we talk about dismantling the military capability of Hamas, what we're talking about is not killing every Hamas terrorist in Gaza, because there's Hamas terrorists right now in Judea, Samaria, the West Bank. There's Hamas terrorists in Lebanon. There's Hamas terrorists all over the region, and they're certainly in Qatar, where they're in posh hotel rooms there. What we're talking about is destroying and dismantling the army of terror that is Hamas. We don't have an exact number of the terrorists who killed, but I think we have a pretty good idea. And, you know, you follow it. Now, when you have terrorists that are above ground and they're engaging our forces, you kill them, you know the exact number. When you're doing operations underground, and a lot of times you have a bombing that hits and collapses an underground tunnel, you may know that there are 3 dozen or 4 dozen, but you don't know the exact number. That's why you don't have the exact specificity of the amount. But our estimate is, I think the best estimate is, we have killed between 11 and 12,000 terrorists in Gaza. I think there were 1,300 people who were killed, terrorists who came in on October 7th.
Mm-hmm.
That's in addition to that. So that's like 12,300. Then you have about another 2,000 that have been captured. So roughly, you're probably between 14 and 15,000 that have actually been killed and or captured. Now, how many are wounded? You don't know exactly the number of wounded.
What's the typical ratio?
Well, the ratio in Gaza, based on the Hamas Ministry of Health, okay? Yes, I'm glad you laughed, because people take these statistics seriously, and we should talk about that, because I break down the Hamas Ministry of Health. But the statistics they have in Gaza is slightly over 2-to-1 wounded. So let's be super conservative, and let's say it's 1-to-1. And as I said, we killed 11,000 in Gaza. So let's say 11,000 are wounded. That means of that force of 40,000, you've killed or captured between 14 and 15,000, and you've got another 11,000 who were wounded. You're already at 25,000, which leaves you about 15,000 terrorists in Gaza across the whole Gaza Strip. Maybe half of those, slightly more than half, are in Rafah right now. And after that operation, you're still going to have several thousand, but they're not going to have any kind of organized structure.
Strategic Affairs Minister Ron Dermer. Dermer also said he was cautiously optimistic that there would be a hostage deal. Listen.
There's hostage negotiations going on now. We hope that it would lead to an agreement. You can never be sure. There's also a lot of problems on the other side, because you're dealing not only with the mediators, but you're dealing with Hamas that has an outside Hamas and an inside Gaza Hamas, and they don't communicate as quickly as you would like, and so you don't get answers back as quickly as you'd like. But let's hope that we can get...
meaning it's not just like, this one, call that one. It's messages have to be transmitted, and then people have to travel with messages.
It's very complicated to do it. You don't
get multiple countries.
You don't get an answer right away. And I hope that we will be able to get into a funnel that hopefully gets us to a deal. We had that first deal where we were able to get out 80 women and children as part of that first deal. Some of them were left behind. Hopefully in the second deal, they'll come back, those people who were left behind. And then we can continue on with this deal. And I'm cautiously optimistic that we can get there. But, you know, you don't know, because it's very complicated. And they always see, I would say, that, you know, Hamas, even though we're in a war that's 5.5 months long, a lot of the war seems to me to have been waged in sort of 1 week or 2 week increments, like people looking 2 weeks down the road. And Hamas had some hopes at the beginning that Hezbollah would come all in, mm-hmm. and Iran would call them, come all in. And then they may have hoped that in terms of hostage negotiations, that the government of Israel would succumb to internal pressures, or that the United States would stop the war. And then they may have hoped that Ramadan would be an opportunity for them to ignite the whole region. So what their state of mind is, I don't know. And the person who's most relevant here in the negotiations is somebody who's not around the negotiating table, right, but who's stuck in a hole somewhere or deep underground in a tunnel in Gaza, which is Sinwar, who ultimately will make the decision if we, from the Hamas side, if we get to a deal or if we don't, and we'll just have to see.
Strategic Affairs Minister Ron Dermer. Contacts on a hostage release deal. A Khan reporter says Israel expects Hamas to respond to Israel's position within 2 days, and only then will the outlook for the discussions be clear. Hamas continues to publicly insist on the demands we cannot accept, the source said. We have to see when the response comes, if there is any softening, and that will be the indication if Hamas is playing for time or truly interested in advancing a deal. Mossad Chief David Barnea is to travel to Qatar tomorrow at the head of an Israeli delegation, the Prime Minister's office said this evening. The head of the CIA, William Burns, is also reported to be attending the negotiations, along with the head of the Egyptian intelligence, Abbas Kamal, and Qatar's Prime Minister, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani. Relatives and supporters of Israeli hostages who are still held in Gaza gathered in Tel Aviv with mental health professionals to present the psychological effects of the ongoing hostage situation. Among family members who spoke last night was Dr. Ayelet Levi-Shachar, mother of hostage Naama Levi. The last sight of her daughter was in a video posted by Hamas on October 7th, showing her daughter being dragged at gunpoint by Palestinian gunmen into a car in Gaza.
I am Dr. Ayelet Levi-Shachar, a family physician. My teenage daughter Naama has been held hostage for over 5 months, 166 days and nights of agony. Far too many minutes and seconds to comprehend since my daughter was brutally stolen from me, from her father, from her three siblings, and our entire family. For Naama and for all the hostages that are still living in the terror of this nightmare, the physical and psychological tortures have not ended. You are all here today, individuals like me, dedicated healthcare professionals, to scream the cry that Naama cannot scream. You know more than anyone what long-term abusive and torturous captivity means for the hostages. Every second is a matter of life or death. For each of us, as medical professionals, there is an additional element. We are ethically committed to saving each life. These are lives that must be saved. But just as important as saving their lives is, we must be able to save their souls. We must help them heal. My Naama must be saved so we can begin the long journey towards her healing. To save one life is to save an entire world. The world of my daughter and all of the hostages must be saved. It is our obligation, not only as medical professionals, but our obligations as humanity itself. Bring them home now.
Dr. Ayelet Levi-Shachar, mother of hostage Naama Levi. A mass prayer service for the well-being of the captives held in Gaza was held at the Western Wall this afternoon, with Jews worldwide invited to take a part virtually. The prayer service, coming on the fast of Esther, included a recitation of the Shema Yisrael in the presence of the families of the hostages, the rabbi of the Western Wall, and other dignitaries. The fast of Esther, which began at dawn Thursday, commemorates the three-day fast observed by the Jewish people in the story of Purim, a holiday that begins at sundown on March 23rd, Saturday night. 134 hostages are held in Gaza. Over 30 are not believed to still be alive. Here's an excerpt from that prayer.
Shema Israel. Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad.
In Judea and Samaria, Israeli security forces carried out a large anti-terror operation in the Nur Shams refugee camp in Tulkarem. Four terrorists were killed, two in an airstrike on a position in the camp, and two during exchanges of fire. The operation began last night, during which several terrorist suspects were arrested and explosive devices were located. Palestinian reports say that a Jenin resident suspected of cooperating with the Israeli security forces was executed this morning by armed Palestinians. According to the reports, the individual is suspected of assisting Israeli security forces who carried out a raid on a hospital in Jenin several weeks ago, killing three terrorists who were plotting a large attack inspired by the October 7th massacre. At El Azhar Junction in Gush Etzion, an Israeli security forces fatally shot a Palestinian who was acting suspiciously. Military police are investigating the incident. The man was later identified as Sama Zaytun from Hebron, who was reportedly in a process of converting into Judaism. A knife was found in his possession. In the south, IDF air defenses intercepted a target heading toward the Israel over the Red Sea. The IDF spokesman said that the target did not penetrate Israeli airspace and that the incident was closed. Residents in Eilat said that alerts were sounded and an explosion was heard. In the north, at least two rockets fired toward the Galilee Panhandle were intercepted this afternoon. Sirens were sounded in Kiryat Shmona and other communities in the area, but there were no reports of any damage or injuries. Earlier, at least three anti-tank rockets were fired toward the town of Metula and mortar rounds towards Dovev. No damage or injuries were reported there either. This morning, Israeli fighter jets struck a Hezbollah military structure in Lebanon, in addition to striking other Hezbollah targets overnight. A launch that infiltrated from Lebanon last night toward the Yiftach region was identified. IDF forces fired at the source. The commander of the division, of the 91st Division, Brigadier General Shai Kelper, says that the IDF is determined to restore security to the north. The road is long, but we are focused on the objective, changing the reality. The deployment of Hezbollah in South Lebanon will not return to what it was on the eve of the October 7th attack, he said. And a Lebanese newspaper reports that a sophisticated Mossad spy ring has been exposed in Beirut. According to the Hezbollah-affiliated Al-Akhbar agency, agents received $200,000 in exchange for information on various sites in the Lebanese capital, especially the Hezbollah stronghold of Al-Dihya. According to the report, the detainees gathered information on the street where senior Hamas figure Salah al-Houri lived 2 weeks before he was assassinated. Another Lebanese newspaper, Al-Nahar, reported that Hezbollah has bolstered security to unprecedented levels in Al-Dihya. We'll have more news coming up, but first this song, Kol HaNachalim by Shmuley Krauss.
Yeah.
recent study by the Brookdale Institute has found that residents of the periphery in the north and the south of the country are more inclined to forgo certain medical services because of distance to access compared to the residents in the center. The study assessed characteristics of health service among residents of the periphery and the center of the country with the aim for improving access for all residents. Reporter Naomi Segal asked Professor Jack Beniel, the medical director of the Ramat Aviv Medical Center and the head of urology at the Beilinson Hospital and the Hasharon Medical Centers, for his perspective on the report finding and steps being taken to address some of the issues.
I read the report, and it actually verifies what I think was done like 5 years ago, where specialist centers, or the availability of specialist care, is missing in the north and the further south. And people tend to go to the emergency room instead of seeking expert advice. In that area, initially, the Ministry of Health tried to augment having more specialists in the north by paying more. And they were giving more money to residents and to specialists to move to these hospitals. It was a project that lasted for about 2 years, and then the money stopped. And at the current rate of changing ministers of health, I think it won't be back for a long time. So another option that we actually have experience with at Beilinson is set up a remote special service, meaning patients can call us or send mail, and then we answer them on the phone. And we have like a third of the visits we have in the clinic are done on phone. So we can call patients up in the north or even in Eilat, and they can have like a first or second call and then come to us for only for a physical exam or some examination they need to do. And some of them get enough advice to solve their problem.
Now, what kind of how would you assess the response to this service? One of the findings in this report was that the tendency to use these remote services was less in the periphery compared to the center, but perhaps that's also a question of familiarity and marketing and making sure that it's known as an option for
those. I think exactly you got the right idea. I think we need the Kupot Cholim to promote these services, like we did now since the 7th of October at Beilinson. We saw that there were 60,000 newcomers to Eilat, and they were all seeking medical advice. So we actually initially sent down teams, and we set new clinics, and then we promoted phone calls, these from our clinics and at Beilinson, Petah Tikva, to Eilat, for certain expert reasons, because we couldn't, you know, bring down all our hospital. But it was very successful. And actually, a lot of the patients were very happy with this. So this is a possible solution.
Yes, in a sense, this particular study preceded October 7th and all of its implications, including displacement of Israelis from their homes. But it probably has also been a testing ground for how to approach the provision of medical services in these kinds of situations.
Exactly. And there are certain medical assistance that is not given at the hospitals, at the general hospitals. And here's the third point, as I want to talk about Ramat Aviv Medical Center. We actually promote new services, new procedures that are not available at the main hospitals. And we have excellent clinics which patients can call and can get very quick assistance. And we do their minimal invasive procedures, like for instead of doing a prostatectomy and an operation for prostate, we have all sorts of at least two techniques where we can solve the problem with minimal invasive surgery. We have several techniques for treating prostate cancer locally, and in this capacity, I mean, patients in the States sometimes, you know, drive for 8 hours to get help. I just read an article about the services at Utah. Mm-hmm. Where they have a special clinic at Salt Lake City, but I mean, they have a state of 2 million spread over like twice the size of Israel, and people need to travel. So, I mean, to travel a couple of hours is not that bad.
And so these services, are these private services? Are they provided within partnerships with the health funds? How does it work?
They're private services accredited by most of the insurance companies, medical insurance companies. And we're trying also to get them into special kupot cholim, but not all of them now. And we're still working on that.
So it's all part of building the broader picture of equitable healthcare services.
Exactly.
Professor Jack Baniel, Medical Director of the Ramat Aviv Medical Center and Head of Urology at the Beilinson and Hasharon Medical Centers. And now a midway look at the major news headlines today. The IDF operation in Shifa Hospital in Gaza kills 50 more terrorists and captures scores more, including senior Hamas and Islamic Jihad commanders. The U.S. submits to the U.N. Security Council a draft resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza tied to a hostage release. As efforts to impose a ceasefire heighten, a senior Israeli minister says Israel would fight on in Rafah even if the entire world turns on Israel. Israeli air defenses intercept an object heading to Eilat over the Red Sea. Mossad head is heading to Qatar amid optimism over a hostage deal. The IDF raids the Tul Karm refugee camp in the West Bank, killing four terrorists. Excuse me. The weather, rain and thunder showers overnight and colder tomorrow. Romania will celebrate a National Day of Friendship and Solidarity with Israel every year. The President of the House of Representatives, Alfred Simonis, announced yesterday in the Parliament in Bucharest that the day will be marked as the date of the Declaration of Israel's Independence, the 14th of May. The bill was approved by a huge majority, 241 in favor compared to 3 opponents. Israel's ambassador to Romania, Reuven Azar, told me that support for Israel in Romania comes from all political parties. He stressed that Israel is not as isolated as it may seem.
Romania was home for the third largest Jewish community in Europe before the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. Even after the Holocaust, following the extermination of about half of Romanian Jewry, part of it was under Hungarian occupation, part of it under the fascist Antonescu regime, Jews have survived, and many of them had emigrated to Israel during the Ceausescu time. The bonds between Romanian Jews and Romania have continued to flourish during all this period. Israelis find Romania a very friendly country. Romania is very open, very friendly. Now, the parliament specifically was the first parliament to pass a resolution following the 7th of October of support for Israel in condemnation of Hamas. The president of the lower house visited Israel and visited Kibbutz Be'eri and other places in the western Negev and committed to show the IDF movie of atrocities of Hamas at the plenum of the parliament. So Romania has been the only country in the world that showed in the plenum this atrocities movie of Hamas in the presence of about 400 members. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, the Romanian parliament hosted only last week the rebroadcasting of the Eichmann trial. So it gives you a hint or an example of how friendly Romanians are towards Israel. The coverage in the Romanian press has been amazingly positive since the beginning of the war. So this initiative that actually came from Deputy Silvio Wexler, who is also the president of the Federation of Jewish communities in Romania, was no surprise. So he initiated that. He got immense support from all the parties in the parliament. And indeed, yesterday, this resolution was approved in the lower house, a week after it was approved in the upper house, in the Senate.
How is it going to manifest itself? What's going to happen?
Well, every 14th of May, mm-hmm. the Romanian parliament will convene and have a celebratory session, mm-hmm. in which the friendship between the countries is going to be discussed. You know, we have many projects between the countries. We cooperate in many fields, in the field of security, in the field of economy. There are many Israeli investments in Romania, in real estate, in traditional industries, in high tech. There is cooperation in agriculture. Now we are at the crossroads because as a result of the new geopolitical situation in Europe, many countries are rebuilding their defense industries, and Israel has a lot to offer in this regard. There is a company here called Elbit Systems, one of the three bigger exporters of defense systems from Israel, that has established here 4 factories. They are now co-producing UAVs for the Romanian army. And we have an opportunity here maybe to bring more Israeli firms like IAI and Rafael, who are looking at the Romanian market, not just to sell to the local forces, but also maybe to use Romania as an export point for third countries in Europe.
You know, this is all good news, and we're hearing such bad news coming from, you know, diplomatics abroad. Canada, for example, decided yesterday to stop all arms exports to Israel. And we have other countries are just sort of seem to be turning against Israel. And so this is a bright light in Romania.
Well, it is a bright light. And I'd like to remind, you know, sometimes people are under the impression that we are isolated, but this is not necessarily the case, mm-hmm. because when you look at the facts, many countries, including Europe, continue to have an interest to cooperate with Israel. Many countries are actually importing defense systems from Israel that are crucial for their defense. So the fact that now, in the context of Gaza, there is some diplomatic pressure, it doesn't really mark a change in the attitude towards Israel, but a concern that has to do more with the situation on the ground, mm-hmm. and the impression that some countries are getting of the situation. But I think that the support for Israel and the support for the relationship with Israel is going to remain strong in the international community.
Now, I understand the bill was approved by a very huge majority, I think 244 and maybe just 3 opponents?
Yeah, that's right. Israel is as we say, if we take from American politics, Israel is a bipartisan issue. It's mm-hmm. a multi-party issue here. Mm-hmm. All the parties in the House of Representatives are very supportive of the relation with Israel.
Israel's ambassador to Romania, Reuven Azar. And on that note, here's Dudu Fischer's song, Romania, Romania, sung in Yiddish.
Romania, 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 Romania. Romania, 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 Gewöhne mol a land, a sie ist sehr feine. Dort zu wohnen ist afar genügen, wo Schluss dein Herz, das kennst du kriegen, am Amelie a pastramele, a carnațele, una glei zale. Ich
besser genizai ay ya pagnikin normeizai ay sizam khay besser genizai oy ya pagnikin normeizai
Romania by Dudu Fischer. As Israel prepares to commemorate the Purim holiday amid the ongoing war, the Tzohar Rabbinical Organization, together with the Or Torah Stone Educational Network, are planning hundreds of community events, including local readings of the Megillah. In its 13th year, Megillah Bekehillah will take place in over 700 locations, including readings in hotels, hosting evacuees, as well as on IDF bases for soldiers located on the northern and southern fronts. A special reading will also take place at Hostage Square in Tel Aviv, dedicated to the safe and immediate return of those in captivity in Gaza. Reporter Naomi Segal asked Rabbi David Stav, founder of and chair of Tzohar, the chief rabbi of Shoham, how to mark the holiday in these complex times.
We are speaking ahead of the 13th year of Megillah in the community events. Before we talk about those, I'd like to ask you, first of all, just about the holiday and how we feel the spirit of the holiday, especially in these times.
Yes, well, as we all feel, we have mixed feelings. On one side, we cannot ignore the pain of tens of thousands of displaced families that were evacuated from their homes in the north and in the south. We cannot ignore the families of those who lost sons and daughters and fathers and parents and grandparents in the war in Gaza. We cannot ignore the pain of the hostages, the pain of the families of the hostages. We cannot ignore, and we shall not forget, the physical and mental pain of thousands of injured soldiers. And yet, we know that we have to change a bit the mindset when we arrive to the holiday of Purim, and we understand that despite of all the pain and despite of all the loss, we are happy for what we have, and we should be proud of what has been accomplished and what we achieved. And Purim is maybe the holiday that from one side symbolizes the rescue of the Jewish people, but not coming to a total peace solution. We don't sit under our dates and grapefruit. And in this situation of Purim, we are in the exile of Paras, in the exile under Haman, and the exile under those people who wanted to kill us. And once we were excused one time, it doesn't mean that the challenges have ended. And we know that throughout Jewish history, we will experience, we'll go through so many terrible events. And yet, we will always forget that we are here to stay. We are an eternal nation that will overcome all its enemies. And despite all the damages that we go through and the massacres that we had to go through this year, we still exist. We defeat our enemies, and we still have a place and a space in our hearts to express our gratitude and our joy for the miracles that occurred to us then and keep on to occur to us every day.
So while these messages can be strengthening, what about the question of how should we celebrate the Halabi Day this year, is there room to perhaps temper some of the traditional events, the parades that are held, how the general feeling? It's perhaps an example of the broader question of how does one go about life in light of the ongoing situation.
You know, I'm in my way now, in my way to mourn a family that this week we're told that they lost their son in October 7th in one of the battles there. And a few days after they discovered that the son was kidnapped, they thought he was kidnapped, the other son got married.
Yes.
And they consulted with me if to do the marriage. And I said, of course. I mean, and it's not only because of the very regular expression, life continues. It's much more than that. The fact that we are so sad for the fact that that boy is not with us and that then they thought that he is kidnapped, does it cover, does it erase the joy that we feel with the second son that fell in love with a girl and they want to establish their life and they want to get married? There's no contradiction between the two. It's true that it's very hard to share the feelings and to divide them to different groups. But basically, we understand that there is a space in our hearts for joy, for what, for the reasons we have to joy, if it's family, if it's community, if it's nation, grandchildren, etc., etc. And there is a space to be sad and to mourn for those who could not live with us now and could not share with us the same feeling. I think that despite whatever I said now, we should express sensitivity to a lot of families that are now mourning their civilians that are hostages, those who are injured, those who could not celebrate Purim in their homes. And we should show them and expose them to the fact that we understand them and we don't ignore that pain. So therefore, if the mayor of Jerusalem would consult with me, I would tell him not to make public parades at this time because of the pain that these families feel. But within closed doors, within the halls and the yeshivot and other places that celebrations will take place, I think people should feel happy for what has been accomplished, should express their sorrow about what has to be expressed. I could tell you that personally in my home, we will leave one chair without a present to represent and to as a symbol for those who could not celebrate today for whatever reason, if they are kidnapped or because of another reason, so to feel that the joy is not absolute and the joy is not 100%, and that we feel that it's the joy is mixed with mourning.
So let's speak a little bit about the project Megillah B'Kehillah, Megillah in the Community. It's in its 13th year. A bit about the events and also how they are also attuned to this sensitive time.
Well, first of all, more than 150 Megillah readings will take place in places that represent or symbolize the situation. More than 80 places or 90 places will be in places, in the army bases that need our assistance, and in displaced communities that asked our involvement. In addition to hundreds of places that we read the Megillah every year in malls and other places, and today, this year, the demand is much higher than in previous years. So that's one thing. Maybe the most symbolic Megillah reading will be in the square of the hostages, in the place where the families to read the Megillah there. And you know, maybe some people don't realize that Esther, the Queen Esther, actually was the first Jewish girl that was kidnapped. She was not asked, she did not go to the king's palace because she wanted to marry, to fulfill a dream of a girl to get married to the king. She was taken to the king's palace. She was actually hostage in the king's palace. And we pray today in the time of Esther Festival, Esther Fest, and we will read the Megillah on the night of Purim in the hostages' square to feel and to express that just like Esther was rescued or was saved then, we urge and we pray and we ask everybody who is capable to do whatever possible in order to bring the hostages back as soon as possible.
Rabbi David Stav, the founder and chair of Tzohar. More information about Megillah, Bekeilah events can be found at tzohar.org.il. In other news, the police have summoned for questioning six minors aged 13 and 14, residents of the Shvela region, on the suspicion that they hacked into their teacher's computer at school and distributed intimate photos of her on a social media network. It was also stated that at the end of the investigation, the finding will be forwarded to the professional authorities for consideration and their decision on the matter. Ahead of the crucial Euro 2024 qualifier match against Iceland tonight in Budapest, Israel's team coach Alon Hazan said the focus on the sport. He is focusing on the sport. At a pregame news conference last night, Hazan said he regrets not being able to play in front of a home crowd. Israel's been playing in neutral countries since the outbreak of the Israel-Hamas war. Hazan also addressed comments reportedly made earlier this week by his Iceland counterpart, Agi Harideh, on being hesitant to play Israel because of the civilian death toll in Gaza. Harideh, for his part, said his comments had been misunderstood. Here are the two coaches. First, Hazan.
We would love to play in front of our supporters in our country in this kind of situation, but we know what happened and we cannot host the game in Israel, so we are focused only here. We don't care how many people will come to support. We like as much as possible, but we focus only in football, and the coach of Iceland say that and other things, so we focus only football, so I don't care if you say that before one thing, and then now we have some sympathy for us. It's very nice, but we play football. In football, when you come, it doesn't matter what happened around. There's a lot of difficult around you, so I'm very proud in my country. I'm very proud to represent my country, but I want to do that in my way, and our way is to play good football, to bring some happiness to our people.
Sometimes you get lost in translation. And it's taken out from a longer sort of sort. I know everything about, I'm interested in politics. I know all about the hostages. And I also said later on that you should free the hostages and stop the bombing and you go for peace, you know, because I come from a peaceful nation and I don't take sides in this political. Even a politician can't solve this one. It's difficult. I know that. So if things been misunderstood, I think it's sad to play games in the situation as is now. It's more that, you know, than taking any part of the conflict. I don't want to do that because we play against football players, and that's very, very important for me. And many of these players have been playing around in Europe, you know, so I have nothing against the Israelis. It is a pity that the situation is like this, you know, and we had Maccabi Tel Aviv, Maccabi Haifa playing away from home. And football should be fair. They had a home draw, and we said there's nothing to do. We go to Israel and play. But they denied to do that, you know. So I feel sorry for the players and the coach.
You have been happy to play in Israel if you've been allowed?
Yeah, if you've been allowed, yeah. It's no problem at all. I think it's for the security reasons. The whole thing is copied. There's no any political reasons. It must be the security reasons.
Iceland's coach, Agi Harideh. And good luck to our team tonight. Taking us up to return headlines is the group Chavrim Shel Natasha and their song B'daka Achad Shfuya, In 1 Minute of Sanity.
B'daka Achad Shfuya הצלחתי לראות את אוניות הצער טובעות בים גדול של תקוות קטנות ויין בדקה אחת שפויה הצלחתי לראות מלאכים בשמי העיר הזאת אלוהים לא מוותר עלינו עדיין אז מה בינתיים הברכיים קרוב לאדמה רחוק מהשמיים צמוד אלייך בינתיים בדקה אחת שפויה הצלחתי לראות את אוניות הצער טובות בים גדול של תקוות קטנות ויין בדקה אחת שפויה הצלחתי לראות מלאכים בשמי העיר הזאת אלוהים לא מוותר עלינו עדיין אז מה בינתיים על הברכיים קרוב לאדמה רחוק מהשמיים צמוד אלייך בינתיים בינתיים
Taking a look at the weather, and the Con weather team said local rain is expected tonight, accompanied by isolated thunderstorms from the north of the country to the northern Negev. Tomorrow, a significant unseasonably drop in temperatures. Local rain is forecast for the north and possibly in the center as well. On Saturday, slightly warmer with drizzle expected in the north. Temperatures forecast for tonight and tomorrow, Jerusalem 11 to 14, Tel Aviv 14 to 19, Haifa 14 to 16, Tzfat 9 to 11, Tiberias 11 to 20, Beersheva 13 to 18, and in Eilat from 16 tonight going up to 23 degrees centigrade tomorrow. Now another look at the major news headlines today. The IDF operation in Shifa in Gaza hospital kills 50 more terrorists and captures scores more, including senior Hamas and Islamic Jihad commanders. The U.S. submits to the U.N. Security Council a draft resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza tied to a hostage release. As efforts to impose a ceasefire heighten, a senior Israeli minister says Israel would fight on in Rafah even if the entire world turns on Israel. The Mossad head is heading to Qatar amid optimism over a hostage deal in the negotiations there. An IDF raid in the Tulkarm refugee camp in the West Bank kills four terrorists. And the weather, rain and thundershowers overnight and colder tomorrow. That's the news. Join us again tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on Kan Reka, the foreign languages channel of the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation. Watch our 2 p.m. newsflash on Kan English Facebook page or write to us at kanenglish@kan.org.il. Together with sound engineer Asaf Moshkovitz, this is Aryeh O'Sullivan wishing you a good evening and shalom from Jerusalem.